is from parts of the Gospel of John, chapter 8, verses 31 to 47, and it's from the New Standard Version translation. Jesus, therefore, was saying to those Jews who had believed him, "If you abide in my word, then you are truly disciples of mine, and you shall know the truth, and the truth shall make you free." They answered him, "We are Abraham's offspring and have never yet been enslaved to anyone. How is it that you say you shall become free?" And Jesus answered them, "Truly, truly, I say to you, everyone who commits sin is the slave of sin, and the slave does not remain in the house forever. The Son does remain forever. If therefore the Son shall make you free, you shall be free indeed." And now verse 43. "Why do you not understand what I am saying? It is because you cannot hear my word." Verse 45. "But because I speak the truth, you do not believe me. Which one of you convicts me of sin? If I speak truth, why do you not believe me? He who is of God hears the words of God. For this reason, you do not hear them, because you are not of God." The word of the Lord. Please be seated.
Thank you, John. Would you once again just briefly pray with me? Father, it is hard almost to say anything after what we have just heard, but I do pray that you would be good to me and to these people, and help us to deepen our understanding of your truth and your word this morning, so that we might live in that truth, that the truth might shape and form our lives, that the truth who is Jesus Christ would be indeed the way, the truth, and the life for us. We pray in his matchless name. Amen. Once again, there is an outline for you. I am only going to get through half of that outline by intention this morning, so you might use it to follow along. And we'll come back after Sinclair is with us in a couple of weeks and complete this tremendous theme from John chapter 8 concerning the truth that frees. A few years ago, my family and I took a great American pilgrimage to Disney World, where every day is the 4th of July. Now, my wife organizes such outings down to the last minute. She figured out exactly how we needed to transverse across Disney World in order to avoid most of the lines. And in fact, all day long, we only waited in one line, because she'd figured it out ahead of time exactly where to go first and second and so forth. But she also decided that in such a large crowd and in such a large place, we would want to spot one another more easily. So she purchased for the occasion lime green outfits for us all. And we're not just talking soft lime. I mean, it's just sort of the bright lime, you know, the kind that glows in the dark. And we all had shirts, lime green shorts, lime green socks, and yes, lime green hats. And we walked around looking about as stupid as one family could in Disney World this day. In fact, I was in line for the only line we had to wait in all day was Pirates of Penzance. And I was in line with my family, and there was right behind me this very normal-looking guy about my age with his family. And he had on a pair of khaki shorts and one of those webbed belts and nice sneakers and a polo shirt. I mean, he looked very nice. And I just felt so embarrassed that at one point, I turned to him and I said, "Most of the time I look like you." But Disney World is an amazing place, isn't it? It's squeaky clean. It's just the way you'd like life to be. It's the ideal America, the past frontier land, the future tomorrow land, the present fantasy land. And for me, however, there was one incredibly unexpected, stunning moment in the midst of our day in Disney World. It's when we went in the exhibit called the Hall of Presidents. Some of you remember this exhibit, I'm sure. Every one of the American presidents is standing up on a stage in a mannequin-type form. And as the show begins, each of the mannequins begins to move in very lifelike gestures in a way only Disney can. And they begin to move around the stage a little bit and talk to one another. And then after a moment or two, one of the presidents steps out to speak for all of them. And you might guess that the one who does, in fact, step out is Abraham Lincoln. And looking for all the world, like every photograph you've ever seen of Lincoln or imagined him to be, he said a brief speech talking about the American presidency. It was very, very moving, very, very interesting historically. But I will not forget one thing he said. In fact, I remember the precise words. These are the precise words. I wrote them down immediately, found a piece of paper in my lime shorts, and wrote these words down. And as soon as I got back to my study, I looked up in my edition of Carl Sandburg to see if, in fact, Lincoln had said these words, and he did. Here is what he said at one point. He said, "I am nothing. Truth is everything." And then he said, "I will perish, but truth will endure." I was transfixed. And as a little bit of a student of history who loves the American presidency and actually enjoys the politics of it and enjoys the institution and dreamed as a child that I would be president one day, I found myself saying, what American president would ever say those words today? What modern American president would speak words like, "I am nothing, truth is everything"? Now, you may have your own idea of which president would have said that. I have to go all the way back to Woodrow Wilson, in my opinion. It's just my opinion. It's worth what you're paying for it this morning. But that Woodrow Wilson, a badly misunderstood man, a man that sort of lost in history, history's not been kind to him, an impractical idealist, but he might have said something like that. But I frankly cannot imagine any president since him saying those words. And perhaps the reason is this. Modern man is not sure if truth is everything. We don't believe it anymore. And we're not sure that there is one truth that will endure. I'm not sure we believe that anymore. You say, well, at least Christians are okay. I mean, at least we believe in a truth that will endure, in an absolute truth. Let me give you the results of a survey that was taken just a few years ago. It is hard for me to believe these figures. The proportion of adults who say there is no such thing as absolute truth. All proportion of American adults, 67% say that. Proportion of people who do not claim any Christian faith, 74% say that. Those two figures you can understand, but the third one is staggering. The proportion of, quote, born-again Christians who say there is no such thing as absolute truth, 52%. What's going on here? Where's the disconnect? There is a disconnect. Born-again Christians who say they believe in the one who was the way, the truth, and the life now tell you that there is no such thing, or 52% of them tell you there's no such thing as absolute truth. Modern presidents, and indeed modern people, would not say the things that Lincoln said about truth because our perception of truth has been changed far more than we know. And one of the commentators on this shift of what's gone on in our own century, perhaps a commentator who does a better job of it than many, is a sociologist by the name of Peter Berger. Now, he teaches at Boston University. Peter Berger is a Christian. He might not fit quite in with our crowd, but he is a believing Christian man. And he, in his writings, he's a very, very well-known sociologist in his own academic field, he writes a great deal about what he calls the pluralization of social life worlds. Now, hang in there with me. This may sound a little academic, but I think it's really valuable. The pluralization of social life worlds, which have to do, Berger says, with the way people see themselves. This is what he says. Agricultural and industrial man, the person who lived in the era of agriculture and even in the industrial era of our Western civilization, lived in a unified worldview. He or she was one and the same person, whether they were involved in family or work or friendships or church or leisure, everyone had a common view of who they were, of themselves, not of the world out there, not of truth, but first of themselves, so that I saw myself as a person, Berger says, who lived in a world that was much more coherent because the coherency centered around my own identity. I saw myself as the same person, no matter where I was. But microchip man, modern man, is many people in one. We're many people in one. We don't have a unified view to our worlds. There's no unified field, as Berger calls it. There's not a unified vision for our lives anymore. We play many different roles. I am a husband. I am a a son. I am a father. I am a minister of the gospel. You are businessmen, businesswomen, housewives, mothers, sons, daughters. Many different roles. And these roles do not necessarily connect with each other anymore. There's no, in other words, to use Berger's term, coherence. I may be one sort of person at work and another sort of person when I'm working out at the Y. And yet another kind of person when I'm at a party. And a fourth kind of person when I'm traveling. And Berger says that because of the plurality of social worlds in modern society, the structure of each particular world is experienced as relatively unstable and unreliable. Do you understand that? In other words, there's no stable identity for an individual because there's too many identities. I wear too many hats. Therefore, there's no one identity that really is stability. And Berger says that the social world is to reflect back on the view of myself. But instead, the social world in which we live, in other words, the world of other people, is what Berger calls a cracked mirror. Now, you've all hung mirrors. Have you ever dropped one? Well, it used to be, before they made them better, that if you dropped a mirror, the glass would not only shatter, but it would spread out. But now, if you drop a mirror, they've made most of them with a safety kind of glass, so that the glass doesn't shatter and splinter and cause damage, but what it does is it ripples all the way through every part of the mirror so that the mirror itself is grossly distorted and shattered in many ways, but not splintered. And Berger says that we are looking at ourselves in a shattered mirror, that we can't see ourselves accurately anymore because there's too many distortions of too many people we're looking at, even as we look at ourselves. There's too many roles. Now, most everybody in the room knows the name Pablo Picasso. Of course you do. And most everybody in the room has seen his paintings. You knew he painted back in the 20s and even before that. He was a man ahead of his time because in his paintings, what he was doing was painting cracked mirrors, right? Why are Picasso's paintings so odd? Why do you see a human form from three or four different angles at once in a Picasso painting? Because Picasso is saying the same thing Berger does, except he was 40 years ahead. The cracked mirror means, for modern man, Berger says, that the institutional order undergoes a certain loss of reality. The individual's experience of himself becomes more real to him than his experience of his objective social world. That's a very important sentence, even though it sounds a little bit heavy. In other words, what he's saying is this: more important than any way in which I see my role in a social order is the way I see myself. Because if I can't trust the social order to give me accurate feedback, the mirror is cracked, I must depend upon some inner sense of who I am. Does that sound familiar? That's the way many of us live our lives. We'll even say, it's far more important what I think of myself than what you think of me. But agricultural man and industrial man would not have said that. Or at least they would have said that there's coherence between the way you see me and the way I see myself. Now that coherence is not there. Therefore, Berger says, the individual seeks to find his foothold in reality in himself rather than outside himself. My foothold in reality comes from inside of me, not from outside of me. Now, this is an extremely important insight into modern people. And it helps to explain the radical subjectivism which characterizes our time. Truth is, as we have often heard it said, truth is what is true for me. And for the modern person, the idea of an absolutely true truth is anachronistic. It's out of place. It's out of time. How can there be one absolute truth or even a set of absolute truths? No, what is ultimately true is what I find to be true. And any claim to absolute truth that is truth with authoritative backing behind it, mediated from some spiritual or social order, is perceived as narrow and maybe even bigoted and dangerous. And that's why, isn't it, that the discussion of abortion in America today is a yelling match. It's a shouting match. Because the people on the other side of the position, from the position this church takes, believe that they have every right. They are acting in good faith. According to their own view of reality, they are acting in good faith to believe that a woman has a right to determine what happens to an unborn baby within her. They believe that deeply. Don't make fun of their belief. They believe it. And they believe it precisely because they're modern. No one or nothing out there in the social order has any right to tell them what they may or may not believe. For the modern person, truth is the degree to which I am authentic. Authentic to myself. It's a good word, authentic is, but I'm not sure it's good what we've done to it. I'm authentic if I'm faithful to my own opinions, regardless of what those opinions might be. You know, maybe some of you have heard this. There's three umpires, three different kinds of umpires. They each represent a different way of looking at truth. You've got the traditional umpire and the modern umpire, and then you've got a postmodern umpire. The traditional umpire says this: there's balls and there's strikes, and I call them the way they are. A traditional view of truth. In other words, there is such a thing as a ball, there is such a thing as a strike, and the umpire calls it the way it is. A modern umpire says this: there's balls and there's strikes, and I call them the way I sees them. You see, his view is different, isn't it? His view says what's most important is the what I see. Not what is, but what I see. And we become today reluctant to make moral judgments based on any external standard. The important result of truth being so completely subjective is that the modern person is highly susceptible to the media's creation of an image. Instead of asking what is there or what is true, the media leads me to ask, what do I see? And the shift from perception of truth is as old as Eden, isn't it? I mean, when the woman saw that the tree was good for food, that she saw it was a delight to the eyes, she saw it was desirable to make one wise, she took and she ate of it. In other words, she based her decision on her perception rather than on what God said. And when she did that, all of the chaos follows. But the compelling enticements of modern information theory multiply exponentially the influence of the media. Modern media reduces everything, values, beliefs, politics, events, to a personal preference, which emphasizes image and appearance rather than truth. Now, you could date the beginning of this in politics. Here it is. It's a political year. It's the third major presidential political year that I've served as your pastor. And I end up saying similar things each of the 3 years because it's very important that we, of all people, we Christians, be wise. But really, this view, this modern view of truth in politics was expressed a generation ago by Joe McGinnis, who wrote a book called The Selling of the President. It was a book about the 1968 presidential campaign involving Richard Nixon. And he quotes from a memo of one of Nixon's speechwriters. Here's what the memo said: "We have to be very clear on this point, that the response is to the image and not the man. It is not what is there that counts. It is what is projected." You go home and you read the front page of the Dallas Morning News. This morning, I sometimes tell you that all I do is look at the front page of the Dallas Morning News on Sunday morning, and I did this morning. You read it, and you tell me if you don't see precisely this working out in the political commentary, not just of one, not just of two, but of many of the political candidates. Perception is everything. But that's a profound lie, isn't it? There's a third umpire. I forgot to tell you about him, did I? And I actually was holding him off for a bit. First umpire says there's balls and there's strikes, and I call them the way they are. Second umpire says there's balls and there's strikes, and I call them the way I see them. The third umpire says there's balls and there's strikes, and they ain't nothing until I call them. That umpire is a postmodern umpire. Not just modern, but postmodern. And what the postmodern person speaks about is the notion of pseudo-events. Events that are created. When I was in college, it was the heyday of college riots. Wonderful, you know, exciting time. We loved it. Not really. You had three students walking in front of a building carrying placards about any subject, and you bring a television camera on to that scene, and you create a riot. You see what happens with a pseudo-event? It isn't anything that exists. The modern view of truth is what I see. The postmodern view of truth that most of us aren't into yet, but our children will be. I promise you, they already are, is this. Truth isn't just what I perceive. Truth is what I say it is. Truth is what I make it out to be. Now look, when Lincoln said truth is everything, he was much closer to Jesus, who said, the truth will make you free. He's much closer to that man than we moderns, or our postmoderns. We're much closer to Pilate in the conversation he had with Jesus, where Jesus says, I was born and I came into the world to testify to the truth. Isn't that amazing that Jesus would say that? I was born and I came into the world to testify to the truth. Everyone on the side of truth listens to me, Jesus says. And Pilate's response, you remember what it is. What is truth? And how did he ask that? As it with an inquiring mind? Oh, yes. Do tell me, Jesus, what is truth? No, he answered it sarcastically, didn't he? What is truth? And he really was pre-shadowing all the radical modern subjectivism of our day. In other words, he was saying, look, Jesus, the only truth is the truth that works. The only truth is the truth that solves my problems. The only truth is what gets the job done. Truth is what I invent. That's what Pilate was saying, way ahead of his time. And when Jesus said, you will know the truth and the truth will set you free, he meant something very different by truth. He meant two things. And we're only going to cover the first one today, and we'll save the next one for a couple of weeks. On your outline, the one we're going to cover is that he means by truth what is called their correspondence. Correspondence. That's what Jesus meant. He means that truth corresponds to what is. So when Jesus said, you will know the truth, he meant that there is a specific content to truth, that there is something concrete which is rightly expressed in words and in statements. Let me put the contrast to you this way. Traditional view of truth, we would say a biblical view of truth, believes in propositions. That is to say, there are statements that are true and there are statements that are false. The modern idea is that there's no such thing as a proposition, there are only ideas. And your idea is as valuable as my idea, and my idea is as valuable as the next guy's idea. But as for there being an absolute propositional truth, no way. But Jesus said, my word is truth. And 24 times in the Gospel of John that we're studying this year, he says, truly, truly, which is to say, it's an Aramaic way of saying, I tell you the truth. And what I'm about ready to say to you is really true. And what Jesus said accurately describes reality, whether he's talking about rocks or resurrections. In fact, the Gospel of John says that not only Jesus speaks the truth, he was himself the accurate speech of God. In the beginning was the Word, right? That is Jesus. And this Word was with God, and this Word was God. It means if you want to know what God's Word is, what God's truth is, on any subject, then we rightly listen, first and last, to what Jesus said. Because Jesus not only spoke the truth, he is the very embodiment of truth. Jesus speaks for God. And if I could put it to you this way, Jesus speaks. Therefore, there is truth. Do you understand? What he speaks is true. Not true for you. Not true if you make it so. Not true if you wish it to be true. True. Some of you have heard of a woman named Nian Chang, a most remarkable Chinese woman. She was born in Peking, what was then called Peking, about 1915. Aristocratic Chinese lady. Her father was a vice minister in the Chinese Navy. She met her husband in 1935 in London when they were both studying at the London School of Economics. And after the communists overthrew Chiang Kai-shek in 1949, the Changs remained in Shanghai where they lived. And Nian Chang's husband was the general manager of the Shell Corporation in all of China. Very big job. The only multinational oil company that in fact stayed in China after Mao Zedong's triumph over Chiang Kai-shek. When her husband died in 1957, Shell thought so much of Mrs. Chang that they hired her to be a consultant, an advisor, and she worked with Shell until Shell pulled out of China in 1966, which was the year that Mao started the great proletarian cultural revolution. In August of that year, 1966, Mrs. Chang's house was ransacked by Red Guards. A month later, she was arrested and she was thrown in the number one detention house in Shanghai, a very miserable place. She remained in solitary confinement in the number one detention house in Shanghai for 7 years. Every once in a while, every week or so, they would bring Mrs. Chang out and put her in an interrogation room. And they would say to her, Mrs. Chang, you may walk out of this prison today if you will say these words. My husband was an enemy of the Chinese people. She refused to say those words for 7 years. Now, I want you to think about that. A little white lie. She knew her husband wasn't an enemy of the Chinese people. Just saying it, though, would have freed her. Why did this Christian woman refuse to say it? Because she believed in truth. And she believed that truth was correspondence. That is, that there is a truth that corresponds to reality, and I cannot violate that truth. It would be wrong. It's not only a matter of integrity for her and her family, it was a matter of what is true. In her marvelous book that I commend to you called Life and Death in Shanghai, autobiography, she talks about making friends with a spider in her cell. And for 2 or 3 years, this spider was her friend. Only friend she had. And she used to talk with the spider. But her whole, in long discourses of interaction with this spider. And when I'm reading the book, I'm wondering, why is she spending so much time talking about the spider? And you know what finally hit me? In her mind, the spider existed. In other words, the spider was real. And the spider had a real definable existence, like truth does. And the spider became very important to her because it was a reminder. It was a reminder that there is such a thing as truth. That words really matter. That existence really matters. Before our service, we pray and we talk a little bit about the service, those of us who are participating in it. And David Ray, getting ready for his pastoral prayer this morning, said, and I asked David if I could share this with you, he said, is it acceptable, as a new guy, he asked this, a new guy on the block, he said, is it acceptable in our church to say the word abortion? And I said, you bet it is, because it corresponds to what is. And therefore, is it right to say in our church, abortion is wrong? Not wrong for you, not wrong for me, not wrong for her. It's wrong. Yes, it is. And the reason I say that is because Jesus spoke words. Do you get it? And that his words were truth. And his words in this word is truth. And when this word speaks a truth about abortion or any other subject, we must listen to it, not through the grid of our own understanding, certainly not in the postmodern mentality that says truth is what I make it. We must listen to the words themselves. The opposite of truth, biblically speaking, is not just factual error. It is a lie. Or it is deception with sad and bad consequences. Jesus calls, in this text, and we'll look more at this next time, Jesus calls the evil one, the devil, the father of lies, because he leads people away from life-giving truth, away from the life-giving truth, the one who said, I am the way, the truth, and the life. If you know the truth, Jesus says, it will set you free. But he's going to go on to say, and we'll see more of this next time, that he is the truth. It's an embodiment of truth. That you can't separate the word of Jesus as a truthful word from the man of Jesus who speaks those words. So let the truthful teaching of the truthful one frame and shape your thinking about your life, about your decisions, about your marriage partners, about your whole life's calling, about what you do with your life. Remember Psalm 86, verse 11. Teach me your way, O Lord, and I will walk in your truth. Give me an undivided heart, that I may fear your name. That's modern man. Modern man has a divided heart, a shattered mirror, Peter Berger would say. We can't even hear the truth. And we must again and again remind ourselves that there is a truth because Jesus is truth and because he speaks the truth. And therefore, we must, in the face of a wicked world that denies that truth exists in any form, we must stand up, and even in the consequences of being thrown into detention house, number one, we must say, there is truth. And there he is. He is my Savior, my Lord. Truth is a person who accurately and truthfully diagnoses who I am. A magnificent person who can look at the sin of abortion and condemn it with his words, but who will, in the very same breath, take the woman who has had an abortion into his forgiving arms and, by the truth, heal her shattered mirror of a soul. I pray to God that you and I will be able to hear the truth who is a person, and we will receive him as the one who lived and died for us, who rose again so that truth would be triumphant, and that we would lean against all and everything in our world today that denies the reality that words have meaning, that truth is truth, that Jesus Christ is who he said he was and is. And that means that if you call upon him today, whatever your sin, whatever your background, whatever your crime, whatever your guilt, whatever your past, if you call upon him, his word is true. And his word says, I save them who call upon my name.